morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, Bill Burke White, our foreign correspondent, professor of international law, is going to be here talking about China and Tibet. Right now, I would like to welcome three residents from the Santa Fe Art Institute. This is something we do about once a month when the residents from the Santa Fe Art Institute have open studios, as they do this afternoon at 5:30. We're joined by Lori Polina, Jeroen Nillemans, and Carolyn Salas. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Why don't we start with you, Lori Polina? You are an artist. You draw. Your medium is graphite on paper. And you're inspired by the work of Cézanne.
Yes.
Tell us about the whole process of your learning from the artist Paul Cézanne.
Well, early on, I guess in college, I studied him under Herschel Chip at UC Berkeley. And started to realize that what I was looking at in his paintings, his later paintings, was his ability to access the subconscious through, through copying nature meticulously. And I think part of that was due to he had an eye problem or whatever, and so that's how he basically saw. But from my point of view, I saw just, subliminal information coming to the surface of his paintings. So for about
it's funny when you talk about Cézanne and meticulous copying of nature, because that's the work that gave rise to cubism, and in a lot of ways is not, at least to the untrained eye, meticulous at all.
Well, that's the subconscious surfacing. That's what I see cubism as, sort of like the articulation of the substructure of reality. So in seeing that, I thought about it for about 25 years, and one day I figured out how to sort of see that way, and I came upon a method of drawing, which is basically autorhythmic, which is to move to rhythm of music, and I'm actually a big fan of Johann Sebastian Bach, and that's all I listen to when I'm playing drawing, I guess. And
so you listen to the music of Bach and draw rhythmically with a pencil or graphite on paper.
That's right. And I erase with an eraser over it, like layering of graphite and eraser. And sometimes I use the side of the graphite stick for like a gray scale. So there's black, gray, and the eraser produces, it sort of digs at the white paper. So that's the white part. So you have a full range of values.
Now, you're also a musician. You play cello and piano.
That's right.
How does the music, both the music that you play and the music of Bach that you listen to, actually affect the work, do you think?
First of all, the piano doesn't come into the method as much as the cello does because of the bowing. It's sort of a very embraceable activity, and so my drawing actually looks like me playing the cello. There's a lot of involvement, a lot of movement. It's almost like dance with the arms and the body. And you do that with the cello to bring the emotional aspect to the surface. But as far as Bach, in all my wanderings through art and music, I've never seen anybody come close to Bach as far as revealing the structure of the universe. And
what do you mean by the structure of the universe? Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, patterns that articulate sort of like a root of a plant. Everything that we see is rooted in something, and I would call it a sub-architectural structure, at least in the visual plane. And so So to get to those roots, to get to those ever-receding roots of visual reality, you have to sort of dig for them like an archaeologist. And so in my scrapings or rhythmic approach to the paper, it's kind of like an archaeologist scraping for patterns. And with rhythm...
It's such an odd comparison in one way, because with a paper you start, there's nothing there. With an archaeologist starts, there's something underneath.
Yeah, but white or black is like the sea or like the void, and that's where it all comes from, the Big Bang.
Talking to Lori Polina. And so you're going to be showing some of your drawings tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute.
That's right. They provided me with a fantastic studio, and it allows me to spread out and draw a lot.
Now, unlike most of the residents who come here, you actually live here in Santa Fe.
I do.
Why did you decide that you wanted to apply for a residency, just to get out of the house for a week or two?
Well, no. Being an artist, I... you know, just do art, and I don't have a job, so I teach music and I house sit for a living, and or for money, or for a home. I house sat for 12 years at an artist studio, and then when he retired, he sold the house. So, and in June, I became studio-less, and so I needed a place to draw, and my last show was last March. So,
and you show at the James Kelly Gallery.
That's right. In Santa Fe, yeah.
In Santa Fe.
And so it's just a matter of needing the studio, and so I applied to a bunch of residencies and got this one, and I'm here for 3 months.
So you spread out, but your work is not, by its nature, very big in scale.
Well, it's only due to the size of Bristol board, which is the medium I work on, and... So the largest is 30 by 40, so that was my aim, was to come here and spread out, get larger, because usually my work varies from 5 by 7 to, you know, 18 by 24. So I spread out, and I also have a video camera, and I'm filming myself drawing, because watching it is actually very interesting, because out of just a bunch of circular motions come these very articulate and almost diamond-like precision images.
And so you'll be showing the videos of yourself drawing as well as the drawings tonight at the Open Studios?
Well, no, but I will probably next month when I have them in computer form.
Lori Polina is an artist whose work can be found tonight at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute, Open Studios, and also loripolina.com, L-O-R-R-Y-P-O-L-L-I-N-A, L-O-R-Y-P-O-L-L-I-N-A. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Turning now to Carolyn Salas. She is a sculptor. Actually went to the College of Santa Fe some years ago, now lives in New York City. Welcome.
Thanks.
So you are doing work, well, you're doing all sorts of things. We'll talk about the project that you're doing here in a moment, but you're also doing something which I find very interesting, which is participating in a show in New York that is about the apocalypse.
Uh-huh.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's a show that my friend is putting on. It's called Home Base. And it's up in Harlem, and it's going to be at this historical landmark, this old brownstone up there. And so we're going to be in the space for 2 months, and we're doing site-specific work. And we were asked to sort of create something that was pertinent to right now, and what we sort of felt the current theme of, like, the times. And so my partner and I are doing a collaborative piece, Adam Parker Smith and I, and we decided to do it on the apocalypse just because it seems to be pretty prevalent. And so we're creating all these textile pieces and objects that we thought one might need in case of an emergency or a disaster happens. And so that's what we're doing.
It's interesting to contemplate what one does need in case of the apocalypse.
Right.
Where does art stand?
I don't know. I mean, it's household items. It's
Lori is saying we need coffee.
Yeah, all these things. I guess. I mean, I have my cats. I'm bringing, and plants, I mean, things that we might hold dear, or, I mean, materialistic objects you can't let go of, or, I mean, I guess just the basic needs for survival, but most of it's household and sort of obscure things.
Do practical things like food, water, and solar batteries or whatever play into this, or are you thinking more about, like, the spiritual needs of people?
I think both. I mean, I was really inspired by The Road. I read that recently. And I also worked on a film, which was sort of I Am Legend. So it was this sort of disaster theme was happening in the past few months. And I really, really was inspired by The Road and sort of thinking about, like, what things kept him going, you know, as far, I mean, his son and the basic needs. But, I mean, just thinking about that whole emotion that you'd go through was pretty powerful.
So you were working on a piece here in Santa Fe that involves a kind of life-size figure and a whole lot of swords.
Right, that's the other installation. I'm getting ready for a second solo show that I have at Priska Juska Fine Art in New York. And so this is one element that's part of it. And it was inspired by tarot cards. The image of one of the tarot cards is Ten of Swords, and it's a figure, I'm sure many of you are familiar, but if not, it's a figure lying on the floor with 10 swords jetting into his back, and you get this card and you think it's the end of the world or the worst thing ever, and it's actually, in fact, just saying that everything that's bad that could happen has already happened to you, so from here on out, things should get better. But so I'm making a replica of this, but with a woman and all these wooden swords that are sort of flying through the air, going towards her and jetting into her back.
And these swords you have carved yourself?
Yeah, I'm hand carving, like, well, not hand carving. I'm actually using the College of Santa Fe wood shop. Brick Fisher is letting me work in there, and I'm hand sanding down all these swords. So there's about, in the end, there'll be about 200 wooden swords.
And these will all, this will all be shown tonight at the...
No, no, this is just, I have maybe like 10 finished.
Oh, okay.
It's pretty laborious.
But enough to
get
pierce open the back of the human figure sculpture that's on the floor.
Yeah.
You also do something, you learned to make molds. You were a master mold maker.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
10 years ago, I guess, when I was living out here, Fran Nicholson, she's a mold maker, taught me how to make molds, and I apprenticed with her for a few years, and it ended up being a career, oddly enough, that I've made for myself in York. So I worked at the Art Foundry out here a long time ago. I did work with Glenna Goodacre, and now I'm doing things with other artists out in New York, and I do special effects and prop stuff for movies.
What's involved in making a mold?
Each piece is really different.
What does somebody give you, and what does a client come to you and say they want?
They could want their body cast, or they could want an object cast, or we could, like, for the movies, I do a lot of prop stuff. So you're, like, setting up for a fight scene or something, so you're making, like, a ton of, like, fake latex bricks. Casting the figure with alginate or...
Oh, so when they throw bricks at each other in a fight scene, they're not real?
No. No. They're light. They're full of styrofoam. And, each time a piece comes, it's always a new challenge to figure out how to do it.
And Carolyn Salas is showing her work today at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Let's turn now to Jeroen Nelemans. He is from the Netherlands and studied at the Chicago Art Institute, and you do installation work and video.
Correct.
So you have done some very intriguing pieces. I don't know, we'll talk about what you're going to be showing here, but there was one that I found fascinating, which was you had set up an aquarium, and then a camera trained on the aquarium, and a monitor which showed this very same aquarium. And then you observed whether people looked at the actual fish swimming around or at the image of the fish swimming around.
Yep, correct.
Very strange. What did you find?
Well, it was basically displayed in a larger display case. And for me, the aquarium and the television monitor are display skis in themselves. So to, in order to get, you know, just a very simplistic live feedback of three goldfish in an aquarium, people confess that they rather see the television monitor.
They would rather see the goldfish on the television monitor than look at the goldfish.
Yes, yes.
What's that all about?
Psychologically, it's we're trained to watch in a box form, and I think we all know what it's like to see nature in television. And
so nature is really more something on the Discovery Channel than it is in real life for a lot of people?
Yes. I think they're equivalent. I think the power of nature documentaries, we all know the inside of a beehive, but never experienced it. So I think the power of the image is something interesting for me and to explore.
So you do other video work that involves using pieces of nature documentaries from television.
Mm-hmm, correct.
Tell us about that.
I'm just one piece that I did was is called "What's Now in Motion Will Never Stop," and it's basically taken from the documentary "Microcosmos" that was done in 1996, and it was one of the first film documentaries where they used extreme close-ups of insects and amplified sounds. And basically every scene where there was like a zoomed-in view of an insect, I downsized it back to a more seemingly 20/20 vision and created all these little images that are just moving around like a, you know, like a film strip. And it's just looping back and forth.
And what was the concept behind that? What were you trying to show that's different from what a nature documentary shows?
It was different in the sense that I wanted to show the image like a specimen rather than what was presented by the image. So if you see a ladybird, instead of seeing it as a ladybird, I wanted to show the viewer that this image of a ladybird is a specimen itself. I mean, W.J.T. Mitchell is a theorist in Chicago, and he basically sees the image as a co-evolutionary system, like a virus. It needs a host in order to live. So the image maker, we as artists or the viewer, are just host for this live specimen that's an image. And, you know, that calls back for me to nature documentaries, where it's also life. And I think it's as important this experience in nature as walking through the forest nowadays. So
you're showing that, and one of your pieces is inspired by the parable of the tortoise and the hare.
Yes, that's actually just started working on here during the residency in Santa Fe Art Institute, and that's very much still in the making. So I'm not sure where it's going or. But it's a new piece that I'm working on and that I will show tonight.
And I think if I remember correctly, it was inspired partly by the work of Stena, which is at Site Santa Fe right now, that great retrospective exhibition.
Correct, yeah. I had the idea for a while, and when we were visiting Stena, I just was blown away by her video pieces and the way it was presented as well. So I decided to dive into the piece and worked on it ever since I've been here. So,
and you also do installation work.
Yes.
And a lot of the installation work that you do requires people to actually walk inside it in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. For me, it was very important the visceral experience for the viewer. I didn't want the viewer just to be a brain on a stick and just walking around the gallery. I really wanted them to have a bodily experience and smell, touch, sight were as equally important.
And so what is, for example, you did one piece which was made of seaweed paper, this green paper, and people walk inside of this construction that you made. What is your, let's put it this way, what did being inside that green construction do for you, and then what do you hope that it would do for other people to be inside of it?
Part was it is just completely imbalance of the body itself within a new structure, within a new space. The bottom floor was mirrored, and then everything was basically seaweed paper. So you had no beginning, there was no end, and it was a complete disorientation. And just not only being mentally aware that something is going on, but physically aware as well. So, and I have to say, once the piece was finished, I was even struck by walking on top of, you know, mirrored structure. It was bizarre, and I will show it also. Some of us will show a little bit of a small artist talk, and I will show some images before the open studio starts tonight.
And so the open studios is tonight at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and all of you will be showing work. And then there's a couple of other artists who are showing work there as well, I take it.
Correct.
Yeah.
And for more information on the Santa Fe Art Institute, you can go to SFAI at sfai.org. And you can also call them at 424-5050. The Santa Fe Art Institute is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, all the way down at the end. I want to thank you all very much, Lori Polina, Jeroen Melemans, and Carolyn Salas, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we will be talking about China with our foreign correspondent, Bill Burke-White. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Bill Burke-White. He is our foreign correspondent. He's a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be with you again, and good morning to everyone in Santa Fe.
And we haven't had you on for a while, unfortunately, so we've got lots of stuff to catch up on, so we're hoping to get back to our monthly schedule with you. You were recently in China and have a lot to say about that vast country. Let's start, first of all, with the whole question of Tibet. There are protests going on not only in Tibet, but all over the world, including the Santa Fe Plaza. What's going on? What is the occupation of Tibet all about in the first place? Why did China occupy Tibet?
Well, China occupied Tibet now more than 20 years ago, and China essentially, in a view somewhat similar to the view we had in the United States in the mid-1800s, that it had sort of a destiny to reach across its continental region up through to the Himalayas and the sort of Indian and Nepalese borders there. The area, of course, was not particularly economically valuable because it's, giant mountain range, but for China, it held a great deal of sort of prestige that it could occupy and would control that territory and would reach as far west as the Himalayan mountains. So China took that territory and over the last 20 years has sought to kind of tame a kind of long-standing Tibetan protest against Chinese occupation. And China has done that relatively effectively, essentially with a strategy of trying to build a kind of Chinese economy in Tibet. The most recent symbol of that, of course, was last year when China finished the highest railroad in the world, linking Shanghai to Lhasa in Tibet. And with that railroad has come a massive influx of Han Chinese businessmen and sort of Chinese governmental control. And what I think we're seeing today in Tibet is a protest against the far greater kind of Chinese presence and occupation that has flowed both, of course, from the political takeover some time ago and the more recent kind of economic invasion, you might say, that has followed the new railroad up to Lhasa.
Now, when you say 20 years, I mean, the Dalai Lama fled in 1959.
And China certainly did, take over Tibet at that point. But for most of the early history, from sort of 59 to perhaps 79 or even the mid-80s, China was only able to sort of govern Tibet in a relatively remote way. China had huge internal problems of its own. And so when I first went to Tibet, which was in 1991, when one got off the plane in Lhasa, Lhasa, yes, one was still in China, but you truly were in Tibet. And it's been in the last 20 years or so that China has had both the economic and military and political power to try to totally transform Tibetan society and culture, and essentially to colonize Tibet with ethnically Han Chinese who have been sent up there to build a kind of parallel universe to the Tibetan one that was able to exist, albeit under Chinese nominal control, from 59 up through the 80s at some point.
One of the reasons that Tibet protests around the world seem to be getting more publicity and more traction now has to do with the Olympics, the Summer Olympics happening in China.
Well, the Tibetans are very wise, and I think the Chinese have feared this possibility, which is that everyone knows, both in Beijing and in Lhasa, that the global eyes are on China from now up until the Olympics this August. And that means that every protest in Tibet gets far greater media scrutiny than it would have but for the Olympics. It also means that the Chinese government in Beijing has far fewer levers of control at its disposal. If the Olympics weren't happening in 4 months' time, and if the Chinese didn't care so much about the Olympics going off relatively smoothly, you might see an even more brutal crackdown in Lhasa than you are. But the Chinese fear, of course, is that if they take a hard line, and I should say they've been doing things like using water cannons and beating monks, but they haven't been openly firing guns and killing people the way they did in Tiananmen Square in the 1990s, if they were to take that approach, you would see, I think, a far greater outcry toward boycotts of the Olympics or others. Steven Spielberg pulled out of his role in the Olympics a few weeks ago, and I think you would see a very vocal outcry protesting the Olympics if the Chinese were to take that approach. So the Tibetans realize they have a little bit more freedom to protest at the moment, and that their protests will resonate on the global stage far more than they would at any other time.
Is the Chinese occupation and colonization of Tibet purely an expression of power, or is there something in that, some natural resource or something like that in that region that they want?
It is mostly an expression of power. Obviously, the Himalayan mountains are a global treasure in a sense. They are not economically viable in the sense that it's not that the Chinese are at this point building massive mines and so forth, though there are likely raw materials and resources there. The problem of being 14 to 20,000 feet above sea level is that it's quite hard to do anything. So the Chinese have now built a railroad, which lets them, engage in far more robust economic activity there. But it is largely a matter of national pride and sort of the creating a buffer zone between China and the Indian border.
We're talking to Bill Burke-White. So China is a government that rules, 1.5 billion people? It's not a democracy. How does the government work? How does it rule?
Well, try to imagine the complexity of governing a country of 1.5 billion people. That's something on the order of 6 or 7 United States of Americas. And it is far from an easy task. So on one hand, one has to give the Beijing government both some amount of credit for being able to govern that many people, and also perhaps a little bit more leeway than you might accord a government like Switzerland that is trying to govern a much, much smaller polity. That said, the government is essentially still run by the Communist Party, and I use the word communist lightly in the sense that the country does not feel communist as in the way we thought of the Soviet Union or even China in the 1950s and 60s, but it is still run by one party, and the major political leaders in Beijing rise up through that party structure. The president, Hu Jintao, has extraordinary extraordinary power at his own disposal, though he is surrounded by a group of ministers and sort of senior leaders. But essentially, it is a government run by fiat from Beijing. There is a kind of parliament. There is a Communist Party Congress. It's currently meeting in its 17th session in Beijing last week, and I believe the meetings are still going on at the moment. But if the president wants to pass legislation or engage in a policy choice, he is largely able to do so freely. There is very little public involvement. The media is nearly completely controlled by the Beijing government. So in terms of the development of policy and the setting of agendas and the passing of legislation, that is done at the very highest levels in Beijing. The challenge, though, with a government or the country of 1.5 billion is that you have to then somehow implement those policies. And much of that has to happen at the regional or even local levels. And so the Beijing government is dependent on those regional and local and city governments to actually implement its authority. And so while power is quite centralized and the Beijing government has sought to centralize power in Beijing, they rely very heavily on implementation at the far reaches of the country, including in places like Lhasa that are extraordinarily remote from Beijing. So it's a governmental challenge of the first magnitude.
How do they pass laws? I mean, everybody who listens to this show has probably heard about the tremendous environmental problems in China, chemicals in the river and global warming and a lot of the things that come from a very rapid economic boom, which is what they're experiencing now. How do they pass laws? I mean, here you have either citizens' movements or corporate lobbyists or whatever. How do they actually pass laws to fix things there?
Well, on the environmental problem, let me just say it is a horrific environmental situation. I mean, one of the days I was in Beijing was labeled as a blue sky day, which meant the entire city was celebrating because there would be some glimpse of blue sky that day. And the Olympic athletes and the U.S. Olympic team, I understand, have now been issued, with masks to filter out pollution while they're in Beijing. And Beijing is not as bad as the industrial centers farther to the west. In terms of legislation, let me give you a comparison with the United States, because I think that is useful. Let's say that there was going to be some new environmental regulation in the United States. The way that would normally happen is that the U.S. Congress would pass some general set of guidelines or legislation, which would then be signed off by the president. But the actual implementation would be done by the Environmental Protection Agency. And the EPA would issue a series of administrative orders, and there would be a period of what's called notice and comment when interested parties in the U.S., that could be citizens down the street from the new industrial plant that's being affected by the regulations to the industrial plant itself, would be able to comment, and then the administrative agency would have to respond before the measures became final. So there's a number of opportunities for feedback. In China, that process is very different. Essentially, the central government in Beijing would simply issue the order and then require that local regulators and officials in the regions implement them. So there's very little opportunity for public interaction and comment. There are some, I should say that part of the problem, of course, is that there's very little information. When I was in Beijing last week, there was exactly zero news about the Tibetan protests, and similarly very little news about the environmental problems. So many people may not be aware of regulations that are getting passed. So that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem, of course, is that freedom of speech is significantly limited in China. And it may be possible for certain groups to speak to the government, to lobby the government, though they are usually industrialist groups, because the government's focus is essentially 100% at the moment around economic development. And so an industrial group could, for example, suggest that a particularly bad environmental policy might actually be counterproductive to industrial development, say building a dam that would flood an economically viable region. They might be able to protest that on the terms of economic development. They couldn't necessarily protest it on human rights or indigenous people's rights grounds, but if the protest was formed or complaint and comment was formed around the very idea of economic development or economic betterment itself, that kind of feedback with the government could well be possible.
So it sounds sort of like one party marginally communist corporatocracy.
I think that would be a fair description. And I think one has to sort of understand the broader challenge that the government in China is facing to sort of see why that structure has emerged and realize the difficulty of moving away from it, which is that, you know, as you yourself noted a moment ago, this is not a democracy. The Chinese people do not have a meaningful vote in their government, which means that the government has to look elsewhere for any viable source of legitimacy. Most governments get their sort of legitimacy from regular elections or some sort of popular feedback process, and that's not true in China. And the Chinese government essentially finds its legitimacy in its continued ability to improve the economic situation of most Chinese. And most Chinese are today considerably better off economically than they were 5 or 10 years ago. To the degree that the government can continue to provide for economic betterment for the majority of people, it can maintain a claim to authority and legitimacy. The problem, of course, is that if the government cannot do that, then it faces real problems and even a potential of collapse, and we can talk more about that. But in terms of why we've seen this kind of corporatocracy emerge that's running China, it's because the government's number one priority is economic development and increased standards of living for most Chinese. And to do so, corporate interests, and some of them are state-run companies, others are private industries, but those have been really given pride of place and the ability to essentially dictate policy or significantly influence policy development.
We're talking to our foreign correspondent, Bill Burke-White. You do have in China, I take it, functional education, healthcare, pensions, public services, transportation, and things like that.
Yeah, the Chinese government has done a remarkably good job in building an infrastructure that functions for a country of that size. If you think about the United States and most of Western Europe, essentially the deal that has been cut between the people and the government, and often this is a tacit deal, is that one gets extraordinary freedoms in the political space, but that one has very few rights in the economic and social space. And what I mean by that is in the United States, our free education system is quite poor. Our healthcare system is often abominable, or at least expensive. It's very good at the highest priced end, but very poor at the lower priced points. And even in Western Europe, while you have a perhaps better education and healthcare systems, the governments have essentially said, we will give you complete and total political freedom, but we'll only make you small promises on the economic and social side. And the Chinese government has essentially struck the opposite bargain with the Chinese people, which is that they've said, you will have no political freedom, but we will give you quite good economic and social rights. So, healthcare in China is, I'm not going to say better than, but more accessible than in the United States. I would still much rather be insured and at an American hospital, that uninsured, and at a Chinese hospital. And likewise, the university system is very good in China and getting better. Still, many Chinese want to come study abroad. The government has provided services that I only wish we could provide here in the United States. So the bargain is almost 180 degrees opposite the bargain we have with our government here at home.
It's interesting. The trains run on time. A lot of the infrastructures you're talking about do work, but when they fail to work, people go bananas.
Right. We all saw this event this winter when the train stopped because of a snowstorm, and you had hundreds of thousands of people essentially rioting in train stations around the country. I took a train the other day from Shanghai to Beijing, and there's something like one train every 7 minutes between Shanghai and Beijing in the evening hours when those overnight trains depart. And the government does a very good job running an extraordinarily challenging infrastructure. But there's, you know, when you have that many people, when anything goes wrong, the size of unhappiness and protest can become extraordinary. The timing in China this winter was highly unfortunate for the government in the sense that it was exactly around the Chinese New Year when millions of migrant workers, and I actually should say tens or hundreds of millions of migrant workers, make their ways from the city back to their home communities, and they only get to do this once a year, and the snowstorm came when they were supposed to be going home, and they were going to miss their one trip home for the year, and so they were deeply, deeply dissatisfied and angry. And you saw a quite remarkable moment where the Prime Minister of China actually flew out to one of these train stations and went and appeared sort of on a balcony over the 100,000 people below to try to quell the unrest. And most of the people there didn't even recognize him because the people have so little contact with their own government. The government has recognized that it becomes vulnerable when anything like this goes wrong because the people have so little other stake in the government, and the government has so little other source of legitimacy, that when something does go wrong, the government has to be very, very careful. And I think that's part of the problem we're seeing both in Tibet and in some of the other autonomous regions at the moment, particularly, for example, in the northwest of the country, where there are some ethnically Muslim communities and some other native groups that are like the Tibetans, feeling extremely repressed at the moment.
China has an ancient, highly developed culture, religious, artistic, musical, medical, culinary, I mean, everything. A lot of cultural expression was really quashed by the communist period. Where do things stand now? I don't know if you can comment on this, but what is the state of Chinese culture today, especially the deep roots of Chinese culture?
It's actually a very sad story, and I'm not a cultural anthropologist, but if you just spend time in China today, what you see is that the country has become extraordinarily disconnected from its cultural roots. And I think that disconnection has come both from the communist era, and if you remember back to the Cultural Revolution, when China essentially decided to destroy its cultural heritage, and then secondly, from the economic revolution, when China decided to bulldoze its cultural heritage. So you go into the cities like Beijing or Shanghai today, and you see that old parts of the cities are being torn down and bulldozed faster than one can possibly imagine, and in their place, 50-story skyscrapers that say Microsoft and Google on them are popping up. But as people have moved out of old traditional villages and moved to cities, they have lost connections with their culture, and the cities themselves have reinvented themselves around economic growth rather than cultural past. So certainly certainly there are linguistic ties and some familial ties still, but it's a country that is deeply disassociated with its past. You go to Europe and, you know, you walk through, whether it's Paris or London, and despite modern economic development all around you, you find the city walls of London or the ancient churches of Paris or Rome, and people still have connections to some degree and understandings of those cultural heritages. And in China, that has been really sort of torn down in a way that is very sad to see. I mean, of course, you can still go and see the Forbidden City and go into a museum and see amazing paintings or vases from the Ming Dynasty, but most people's daily lives are deeply disconnected from that past.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. In every country where there's repression, there are always intellectuals and an underground who try to find out and who succeed in finding out, often at their own expense, what the truth is of the government that they're living under, of the rest of the world, and so on. There's a real media blackout to the extent that the SantaFeRadioCafe.org is not available in China. It is blocked. I don't know why. I've never done a show on China, but until today. But how do people who really want to know find out what's going on in their country and in the world?
Well, if anyone in China is listening, we are not criticizing completely. We're also recognizing the challenges that they face. So maybe we can unblock Santa Fe Radio Cafe .org. But in today's sort of completely interconnected web and quick information flows, it's very, very hard for a government to block out all information. Now, that said, when I would pull up CNN.com on the web in Beijing, I would not be able to see the stories about Tibet. They were just missing, whereas if I pulled it up on the U.S. version that I could access through my BlackBerry, I could see those stories. So the government is censoring, but I think the government has essentially recognized that it is impossible to keep the true elite from finding out what's going on in the world, and that means that if I'm sitting at one of the major universities in Beijing or Shanghai, I can essentially go to a kiosk and pull up major world newspapers and have access to most information. And certainly that information can be emailed around, and people do that. So you find that the upper most educated and sort of elite classes have very good information. And in fact, the business people have complete information because they need that information today to operate in a global business environment. And where there is an economic need for it, the Chinese government has recognized that they have to allow that kind of information in. But the average Chinese person who is listening to, for example, the state-controlled radio or television stations is getting a version of the news that doesn't tell you about Tibet, that doesn't give you the full story. And I think the government has said, okay, well, let the elite have some of that information and only crack down against them if they use that information to agitate against the government in some way. So if you just want the information and just for your own good, you can probably get it. The danger is when you start to use it in some way. But for the majority of the Chinese people, in some ways similar to the majority of Americans, the news sources are relatively limited and controlled. Fox News gives you one version of the story, and if that's all you listen to in the U.S., you're going to have one version of the news. And the same is true in China, except the state-controlled media is even more controlled, certainly, than Fox News is.
It is a sort of weird and interesting parallel between the two. Is there a pro-democracy movement at this point in China?
There is a pro-democracy movement, but it's very much underground and very quiet. Most Chinese have been happy to accept the increase in their aggregate welfare and say, okay, that's good enough. There is an elite movement, partly in universities and in some of the major cities, that are pro-democracy, but they have very few outlets with which to voice their displeasure. And if they do, many of them end up either in jail or repressed in some other way. And so you don't see a very active pro-democracy movement today, certainly not like you saw in Tiananmen Square 17 years ago, 18 years ago. But it is there, and my guess is we'll be hearing more from it as the Olympics approach, because that pro-democracy movement recognizes that they have a window of opportunity here, similar to the window in Tibet.
We've got just about a minute left. What were you doing in China?
Well, I was there conducting research, looking at how China is interacting with international law and international legal institutions. And it's a very interesting question. I'm comparing Russia and China, trying to understand why it is that Russia has been able to completely isolate itself in the last few years from the international legal system. And that's largely because Russia's pumping out oil, whereas China has had to completely integrate itself on the economic side, joining the WTO, entering into investment treaties with other countries in order to fuel its economic development. And so we've seen two very different paths between these two countries as they have risen in power.
Bill Burke-White is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. He is our foreign correspondent with us approximately once a month. Bill, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
The pleasure is mine, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Excellent.
Take care.
You too. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Hasta la vista. Ciao.